You only get to bring one person to the Lord, but you're guaranteed that you'll be able to bring that person to the Lord. Who would it be? Now, I'm not going to ask you who it was, but I suspect if I did and we did a tally, 80% of you would have chosen somebody from your family. Not necessarily that would be the case, but very, very often that is the case. And I think it's because we feel a little bit like the Apostle Paul did in Romans chapter 9. He wasn't talking about a specific member of his family, but he was talking about familial ties. I say the truth in Christ, I lie not, my conscience also bearing me witness of the Holy Spirit that I have great heaviness and continual sorrow in my heart. For I could wish that myself were accursed from Christ for my brethren, for my kinsmen, according to the flesh. I think if we would ask Paul, list somebody that you would love to bring to the Lord, and we know Paul did many, many, it would have been somebody of his flesh. And that's true many times of us, and that's our subject tonight. Handling, dealing with, converting, whatever word you want to put there, unbelieving family members. In Matthew chapter 28, verses 19 and 20, we have the Great Commission where Jesus told his disciples to go into the whole world and preach the gospel, teaching them and baptizing them in the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Ghost. He didn't specify family in that Great Commission, but he sure did not exclude it, did he? Why is it so much easier for us to evangelize across the ocean than it sometimes is to evangelize across the street? Why is it oftentimes easier to share the gospel with a stranger than it is an acquaintance? And why is it often easier to share the gospel with an acquaintance than it is with our very own families? Now, I don't know that I have all or even very good reasons for that. I find it very, very intriguing. I think part of the reason is fear. Not that we're afraid of our families, but we're afraid of a loss of a relationship or a rejection. And the closer the person is to us, the more we fear that loss and that rejection. And while I understand that to some extent, it does seem a bit backwards to me. Because the ones that are closest to us should be the ones that we care the most about. And I think we do care the most about them in a filial way, but not necessarily in a salvational way. Maybe it's hard for us to share the gospel with our families because they know our shortcomings so well. And if there's any threads of hypocrisy in us, they are more likely to know it than people who know us less well. So maybe we're just less effective because of that. I sometimes think within families, certain members of families, there are rivalries. There is sometimes competitiveness. And if you thought of it, they're going to be against it because you thought of it rather than them thinking of it, or vice versa. Sometimes within families, there are histories that we don't know what the history of each family is that causes members of one of the family not to be receptive to members of the other family. But isn't it wrong to fear losing them for a few years here on earth and be willing to lose them for eternity in hell? I'm trying very carefully, because we're all in the same boat, not to make this a guilt trip, but do make it rather pointed. Who do we talk to other than our brothers and sisters in the church, for many of us, more than our families? What brought you to the Lord? What brought you to the Lord? Again, I suspect if I took a poll, a high percentage of you were brought to the Lord by your families. Well, wouldn't that be the same resource that's more likely to bring unbelieving family members to the Lord? It's an interesting exercise. I hope it's more than just a mental exercise. Every Christian, everybody here tonight, has either a family member, a friend, a co-worker, or a very close acquaintance who is not a Christian. I'm going to go out on the limb, and you may be the exception to this, and say that there's a very strong likelihood that everybody here has a family member, a friend, a co-worker, or a close acquaintance that you have never shared the gospel with. I think it's number 141 in the red. It's a good song. I hate to sing it. You never mentioned him to me. Sharing the gospel with others is probably always somewhat difficult for most of us, at least in the initial stages. But it becomes even more difficult, in my personal and professional observations, when it's someone close to us for whatever reason. And I think maybe Jesus knew to some extent that was going to be the case. I'm going to read to you Luke chapter 12, starting with verse 51, for three verses. Luke chapter 12, verse 51. Suppose ye that I am come to give peace on the earth? I tell you no, rather division. For from henceforth there shall be five in one house divided, three against two, two against three. The father shall be divided against the son against the mother against the daughter against the mother-in-law against her daughter-in-law, and the daughter-in-law against her mother-in-law. Now, it was not Jesus' desire, obviously, we know, to split families. But I think he's somewhat prophetically telling us that it is going to happen. It's happened in my family, and it has happened in your family. However, we are commanded to share the gospel. And I can't find in Scripture one single excuse for not doing it. Doesn't Peter tell us in 1 Peter chapter 3, verse 15, be ready to give an answer in season and out of season to everyone that asks? In Mark 16 and 15, Jesus said, go into the world and preach the gospel to all creation. We read those words, and I think we have an honest desire to do them often. I don't know that I think we have an honest desire to do them always. And we open our eyes, we see the world, and sitting right in front of us are our own family. Why are they so difficult for us to not only convert, why are they so difficult for us to approach? Shouldn't the home be the best place, the easiest, the most convenient place? Have you ever thought Jesus was raised in a family of non-believers? He was the only believer, at least initially, in his family. Nobody that I can find in Scriptures believed him, even as his ministry began. You and I have family members that don't believe? Well, I guess we've got good company. Jesus had a house full of them. But some of them were converted. Two of his half-brothers are writers of the New Testament, James and Jude. Now, they delayed in becoming followers, and the Bible doesn't give us a lot of detail as to how and why they were converted, but I want to think just a little bit about that with you this evening. Jesus spoke to Peter, who followed him for 3 years, and said, "Simon, when you are converted, strengthen your brothers." Now, that could have been a reference to physical brothers or national brothers. But there was a family context in what Jesus hoped Peter would do. If you've ever had the opportunity to work with a new convert, it's after they've been converted, it's one of the most amazing things. They're zealous. Their prayers are fresh. But I've often found they have this tremendous zeal to tell all of their family about what they found. The sad part of that is sometimes as the years go by, we lose that. We feel defeated. It's no use. It won't work. I tried and it didn't work, or worse, I didn't try because I knew it wouldn't work. If Jesus were a member of your family, what effect do you think that would have on your family members? Would more of them be Christians if Jesus was a member of your family? I suspect in my case, they would be. Well, Jesus says he's going to come back to earth and be a member of my family, so what's the next best thing that we can do, or I can do? I think the next best thing that we or I can do is be as much like Jesus as absolutely possible within our families to have the effect. There is no record in New Testament of Jesus giving his brothers a tongue lashing or a sermon. But something changed those men and probably his sisters over the course of his life. His brother James in Acts chapter 15 was one of the great pillars in the church at Jerusalem. Now that would be hard to grow up with somebody and then all of a sudden say, well, that's the Son of God, you know. We just don't think in those terms about people that we know that well. I'm going to, in rather bullet fashion, but it's going to take me just a little while, run through kind of a progression that I see in Christ's family from snippets of passages that we're given. I'll go rather fast, so if you want to turn, feel free, but I'm not sure that you'll necessarily keep up with me. There's an old saying, familiarity breeds contempt. Well, it also breeds children. And that's where we get our families. And I believe the most important mission field that you and I have, and this doesn't mean that one soul is more important than another, but the most important mission field that each one of us have is our family. In Matthew chapter 1, verse 25, it says, Joseph woke up, and he did what the angel of the Lord had commanded him, and he took Mary home as his wife. Now, we understand that they weren't yet married. They had not had sexual intercourse, because Mary had been impregnated by the Holy Spirit. But Mary was not a perpetual virgin. Because in John chapter 2, verse 12, we find that his mothers and brothers were with him. When Jesus, at the age of 12, was in the temple, that's the last record we have of his father, Joseph. I don't know if Joseph died between the time Jesus was 12 or 30. My guess is he must have, because there is no record of Joseph after Jesus' appearance in the temple when they were down in Jerusalem. But we do have his mother and his brothers frequently found in scriptures. In John chapter 7, verses 3, 4, and 5, his brothers say, you ought to leave and go to Judea so that your disciples may see the miracles that you can do. Now that sounds like they're believers, but listen to the rest of this. No one who wants to become a public figure acts in secret. Since you're doing these things, show yourself to the world. And then in verse 5 it says, for even his own brothers did not believe him. I think they were talking in sarcasm. Go up and show those other people. But they weren't believers. They didn't believe in his purpose. They didn't believe in Him. Can you imagine growing up in the same house with Jesus, someone who never sinned, was always doing the right thing at the right times? I suspect there were some family squabbles over Jesus' character. Well, he never gets in trouble. Now, I'm speculating a little bit, but if I lived with someone like that, I'd probably have some conflicts. In Matthew chapter 13, verse 54, when Jesus is coming to his hometown, he begins to teach the people in the synagogue, and they're amazed. They were amazed, and they said, "Where did this man get this wisdom and these powers? Isn't this the carpenter's son? Isn't his mother's name Mary? Aren't these his brothers, James, Joseph, Simon, and Judas, who we know as Judah? Aren't his sisters living with us?" That's when Jesus said, a man is without honor in his own home. Jesus' family, Jesus' neighbors, Jesus' hometown did not believe and they did not honor, at least at that time. Later, Jesus is in Nazareth after a bitter discussion in the synagogue, and we read that all the people in the synagogue were furious when they heard this. They got up and drove him out of town. Remember, they took him up on the brow of the hill to cast him over the cliff, and he just kind of disappears. Now, I don't know, but I wouldn't be surprised if some of Jesus' brothers and sisters weren't in that crowd, and I'm very confident that some of his relatives were. And yet, at the end, some of Jesus' family had been converted. How was that? Well, as we have experience with family and relatives, one of the things that sometimes we have to get past are strives, envies. There needs to be some reconciliation and forgiveness. Nothing will bring a family together quicker than forgiveness. Nothing will split it apart quicker than jealousy and conflict. And there are examples represented here tonight of families that are tight and families that are loose. Most families have pockets of both. Steve Bowen, in a little article called Family Discipleship, and I don't usually use acrostics, but I thought this was fairly good. He used the acrostic share. And he gives us three, I'll call them suggestions, for dealing with non-believing family members. And let me just relatively quickly go through them because time will get away from us. The first one is to serve them. Preaching, many sermons, pointing out their faults, telling them about hell, leaving Bibles and gospel tracts all over their houses, might not be bad, but in my experience, it's not terribly effective. What has to happen is there has to be a relationship of service. In other words, actions speak louder than words. The same way, let your light shine before men. Francis of Assisi once said, and I always thought he had a nice quote, he said, "Preach the gospel at all times, and if necessary, use words." And I think this is especially true in families because of all people that maybe you or I don't want coming telling us what to do, it's our brother or our sister or an aunt, or mom and dad once we're adults, or well, even when we're kids, I guess. Serve them. He then goes on and says, you need to hear them. Another way of saying, you need to be willing to listen rather than simply talk. Hear their pains. Hear their concerns. Hear when they're having trouble. Hear their dreams. Ask them about their disappointments. James, in James chapter 1, verse 19 of his book, says, "Dear brothers, take note, everyone should be quick to listen, slow to speak, and slow to become angry. If that is ever true," and it is always true, but if it is ever true, it's true in the family, isn't it? It's wrong to try to persuade someone by manipulating them. It's wrong to try to convert somebody by making them feel guilty. And if you are gifted with the capacity to manipulate and flow guilt, you might get an action, but it won't be a conversion. It won't be a conversion. Many times we are harder on our family members than we are on anybody else. Now, God forbid that anybody else gets hard on them, because then we'll jump up and defend them. But we are harder on our families than probably anybody else. I expect more of my boys than I do of yours. That's just natural, I guess. I try not to be hard on them, and maybe sometime you'll give them time for a rebuttal. But we are harder on those that are closest. They've done studies. Men are more polite to their secretaries than they are their wives. But don't get smug, ladies, because you tend to be nicer to the checkout boy at the grocery than you do your husbands sometimes. I want to think that all families represented here tonight are exceptions to that, but you get my point. Ask questions. One of the most, and this is not just in religion, but that's what we're talking about, the most effective way to get close to somebody is ask them questions so that they will start talking about themselves. I have yet to find anybody seriously in private that doesn't enjoy talking about themselves and what they like. It goes along with hearing and listening. When you hear someone, and we're talking family members, say, "I don't believe in God," what would be a good response to that? Well, maybe the response shouldn't be, "Well, you silly goose." Maybe something like, "What's so hard about believing about God?" Now you've got a dialogue started. Or maybe you would say, "Well, is your disbelief in God due because of some experience you had with Christians? Or is it due to a bad experience you had with God?" And you'll be amazed how many times it's really a bad experience with a person, not a bad experience with God. Sometimes you'll have family members that are talking down the church. Ask them, "Well, what turns you off about the church?" Now you've got a dialogue going. The worst thing I think we can do is respond in shock and distaste. I like to ask people, and this isn't just family people, but anybody, "What is your biggest fear?" And they'll give you a fear. I don't know what it'll be. And then you have a chance to tell them what your biggest fear is. "Well, I know what my biggest fear is, that I won't be ready to meet my Maker when He comes." Now we've got a dialogue. He then goes on and uses the phrase, "rescue them." Well, there's limits to what we can do there, because people have to rescue themselves spiritually, don't they? But if we saw that same family member drowning, would we stand there and say, "Well, I just know nothing I'm going to do is going to work, so we just watch them bubble down"? No. Now, what we try might not work, but we would frantically try as anything we could think of to keep them from drowning, wouldn't we? I believe everybody here would do that. Why should we be less urgent in them sinking into the pits of hell? Sunday morning at Dean Avenue last week and at Pleasant Hill this week, I talked about time. You know, we just don't have a whole lot of it. And a lot of us don't have a whole lot of it left. There is an urgency in this. In 1 Thessalonians chapter 5, verse 19, Paul says, "We urge you, brothers, warn those that are idle, encourage the timid, help the weak, and be patient with everyone." In 2 Corinthians chapter 6, verse 2, the same Paul writes, "I tell you, now is the time of God's favor. Now is the day of salvation." And he ends with encouragement. And this obviously takes many forms depending upon the person. But encourage them in terms of telling them what Jesus has done for you and maybe your immediate family. Offer to pray not only with them but for them. And certainly keep the relationship open. There's an interesting verse in Acts chapter 1 verse 14. Remember, Jesus started off with his family pretty dead set against him. Well, in Acts chapter 1, we've had the crucifixion, we've had the resurrection, and we've just had the ascension. And the 14th verse says, "These all," these are the people that Jesus left at his ascension, "these all continued with one accord in prayer and supplication with women and Mary, the mother of Jesus, and with his brethren." All those brothers that didn't believe were there at his ascension. And it implies they went back to the city of Jerusalem and waited as he had instructed them to. I find that very interesting. James, as I said, became an important leader in the church at Jerusalem, and he wrote the book we have in the New Testament. Judas, we know as Jude, wrote the book of Jude. And I kind of go back to a passage I used Monday night on doubts. Jude, verse 22. Now this is Jude, the brother of Jesus, who went from not believing to believing. He writes in the 22nd verse, "Be merciful on those who doubt." Well, we've all got family members that doubt. To the extent they're not Christians. Jude, who went through this process in some way, I'm intrigued with how it must have worked, but we don't have that much information, or maybe we'll get to ask him someday. How was Jesus patient and merciful? What was it that caused you to come to the Lord? Okay, that was definitely a monologue, but I just find that intriguing, and I find it so, so important. I'm going to stop and see if you have comments or questions or experiences or issues you'd like for us to discuss specifically in the 15 or 20 minutes we have left about bringing family members to the Lord. Some of you have had blessed with being able to do this on occasion. Many of us are still frustrated about doing it. So I will pause if you have something you would like to share or ask. Somebody thought I called Marty Mike last night. I don't think I did. I think I said, "Here comes the Mike." So I feel better. Allison?
I am wondering how you have the balancing act of a family member who previously is a believer, and so you're supposed to not, you know what I'm saying? You're not supposed to be super nice to them. I mean, you're supposed to be nice, but you're supposed to kind of shun them somewhat because they're no longer a believer, and the balancing act, but then of also trying to bring them back to the Lord. It's just kind of, I think you get it.
I understand your question. I don't know if I understand my answer yet. What she's talking about is that balancing act, like we have instruction in 1 Corinthians 5, you know, don't even eat with them. And then in 2 Thessalonians 3, it says, but admonish them as a brother. Well, obviously, and we've talked about fellowship when I've been with you before. I don't believe that shunning is very often the right thing to do. But in a case that she described where we're talking about someone who, not someone who has never accepted the Lord, but someone who has and has drifted away. there has to be a clear indication to that person, I believe, that that relationship has changed for the worse. I think that's what we see in 1 Corinthians 5, and then later in 2 Corinthians 2, it's called godly sorrow. We're only doing that to try to jar that person, if you will, into coming back. It's not retribution. The balancing act, I think, is we are going to have to continue many times, and we should most times, I think, have interface and contact with our family members, because I don't know how to have any kind of effect on them if I don't. Having said that, I think we can make a serious mistake by going on as if nothing happened and nothing changed. And I'm sure we err on both sides on occasion. And I know I've shared this with you. My sister was a Christian, and now she's in another religious organization. It has affected our closeness tremendously. But she's still my sister, and, you know, if for nothing else, for the sake of my parents, we have a relationship. And we don't have an adversarial relationship, we just don't have a communal relationship. But I think it is a balance. But I think we need to be careful that we can go back and use some of these things. A person like that, an opportunity might come up, well, what made you quit believing? What was it? And maybe that's even a little bit too blunt. Do you still believe in God? Get them talking. And maybe it'll lead to some of these things. You may find out that their issue really was because of a person and not because of Christ. And I don't know. Each case is going to be different. But I contact needs to continue, but that contact can't be of the enabling nature. I guess that's the way I'd like to say it. Sometimes contact is to admonish and to teach and to encourage. Other times contact is enabling. And by that I mean we act as if, well, no big deal. We just go ahead and do what we've been doing. I question whether that's wise. So that's about that's my thoughts on it. Do you have a follow-up? I suspect you're right, and not just talking about your family, but if you can't remember why you left, then just come back. But that's easy for me to say. You know, but things that have been 30 years ago when you're, what, 31, you're not going to have a lot of recall on that. Turn that over to somebody that's 60. Anybody else have a comment? Marty.
I think you just answered my question, but I'll ask it anyway. How are you defining unbelieving? Are you referring to those who have never accepted Jesus, or are you including those of a different religious persuasion who don't worship correctly as we understand the Scriptures?
I'm including both, but the major thrust of my comments have been for those about those who have never accepted, but I think it's very similar in its result, although your approach might be different, because someone who was a member of the Lord's church and went to another denomination, they probably still have some of those basic beliefs. They may still believe the Bible, still believe in Jesus. So you would start with them in a different way, in a different place, with different questions. But it would include both, I think. Anybody else? Comment or a question?
I just wondered what you thought about the wisdom of trying to conduct a study or a line of questioning like this yourself, or getting someone who's maybe not quite as close to do it. We have a situation where we're trying to influence my mother-in-law, and it may rub her the wrong way if we were the ones to do it. Because she's not used to
that. Pardon.
Yeah, admitting that we might know something that she doesn't might be hard on her pride, I think.
Yeah, mothers-in-law don't always welcome sons-in-law correcting them. But maybe occasionally they do. But that's going to depend upon your relationship. If you've got a good relationship, and I've got family that I have a real good relationship, and I'd probably be the most effective. I've got family that the last thing they want to hear is me telling them what to do, so I need to get you to come and do it. So you got to use some judgment. But don't use that as a cop-out. Don't use it as a cop-out. Whether it's you or somebody else, do what you can to facilitate it happening. That's the key. Okay, you can be thinking. I've got plenty more. Temperament, I think, is extremely crucial always, but especially in family situations. Sometimes you have a little family get-together, or you just go over to aunt and uncle's or mom and dad's, and an argument breaks out. As much as you can, stay out of it. Because most of them are stupid, and they're silly. And the last thing you want is people taking sides and you being on the opposite of somebody's side. It's going to affect your witnessing capability. Now, I guess sometimes you can't stay out of it. I don't know. I can, or I have been able to. But don't get caught up in petty family strife. And 99% of family strife is petty. I'm sorry, but it is. On a scale of 1 to 10, it's not very salvationally important. But it can hinder this whole process. Another thing I would share, or I want you to consider, is be insistent and consistent on your Christian principles. There's a dear, lovely widow lady who lives south of here, significant distance, but when her children, who don't live close to her, come back and visit her on the weekends, she stays home with them on Sunday morning. And she will probably never have a witnessing effect on them. I don't know if you've ever been tempted to do that. We need to be insistent and consistent on Christian principles. I know of cases where sons or daughters have brought back for the weekend their significant other and expected mom and dad to let them and their significant other share a bedroom. Be consistent and insistent, not harsh and cruel. But if you are not consistent, people who don't believe are looking for a reason to continue not believing, and our inconsistency, or dare I say hypocrisy, is often all they need to keep from coming to the Lord. Now, is that going to be sometimes hard to do? Sure it is. But I think it's extremely, extremely important. I think we need to be sharing with our families. And I would like to think we are. But sometimes you'll hear family members say, well, you know, stay out of my room. Stay out of my door. Who's been in my door? Well, we need to respect one another's privacy. But there needs to be an element of sharing there. And I would also add, I think we need to have an attitude of empathy and not superiority. And I'm going to have to be a little critical of some of us, with a capital J. It's easy for us, if we're not careful, to wear our Christianity with an aura of superiority to those who aren't Christians. Well, we're not superior to them, other than he that is in us is superior to he that is in them. But having empathy with them, and remembering that we were once lost also, is a much better attitude to take to the table than we've got it all figured out and we're here to explain it to you. Well, that might be true. It's very tactless. But we need to be empathetic in our approach one to another. Anybody have a comment or a question you would like to make before I just keep going? Okay, I haven't mentioned a belief... mates, when one is believing and one isn't. And I think you've studied that probably well. But obviously, if you are married to someone who is not a believer, that does not negate your wedding vows at all. You are still their husband. You are still their wife. Sometimes we don't take 2 Corinthians chapter 6, verse 14 very seriously, and I think we should. Be not unequally yoked together. Well, the Lord gave that to the Israelites in their fields. He didn't want a donkey and an ox yoked together because one pulls harder than another. I ran across a little saying, an old Tennessee farmer hitched a mule and an ox together. Someone later asked him how it worked, and he said, well, it would have been all right if my field had been round, because all we did was go around in circles. And we've all seen that happen, haven't we? Now, we've seen it work out. But the tragedy of how many times it works, doesn't work out, is tremendous. But 1 Peter chapter 3, verses 1 through 7, 2 Corinthians chapter 7 gives some very candid instructions how to handle the unbelieving family member when it's our mate. Peter in 1 Peter 3 says she should do it by her example. Thursday night at Dean Avenue, I talked on 1 Timothy 4:12. Some of you were there. And it was all about Paul's admonition to Timothy to be thou a good example. And obviously, if we're going to influence anybody, especially our family members, we have to be a good example. However, having said that, I don't think we should stop with simply being a good example. We do need to share the words of the saving gospel with people. If we do not, then we need to ask ourselves very seriously how much we really love them. And I don't say that to be harsh. But I can't think of anything less loving than not sharing the gospel with someone that we have an opportunity to do. Is it easy? Always? Absolutely not. But what is more important than that? Well, we could talk about this for a lot longer, but you probably listened about as long as you need to or want to. But I think many of the things that are applicable to sharing the gospel with anybody are also applicable to our families. But families present a special opportunity, but they also present a special challenge. The opportunity is we're familiar with them, and we have oftentimes rather easy contact with them. The obstacles are we have history with them. Maybe they've been offended by us. Maybe they're jealous of us. Maybe you're more successful than this cousin or this brother or that brother. They may be jealous of you. You've got to work through that. But somehow, there's nothing more important than sharing the gospel. Having said that, we can do everything right, and it may not work, because ultimately, accepting the gospel is between an individual and God. And you can't make somebody accept the gospel, and I can't either. It's ultimately their decision. Our charter is never to convert people. Our charter is always to share that which the Lord has given us. Few things more heartbreaking for parents than children that aren't in the Lord. Well, I hope you've done the best you could. And I hope you take every opportunity to do it. But don't enable them. We have enough adults in this world that have never grown up without you and I adding to the mess. And sometimes the most loving thing to do is what they call tough love. Tough love. Questions or comments?